Resource Committee to order. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2930. And Patrick, do you want to explain a little bit about it to us?
Yes, Madam Chair. House Bill 2930 was one of the measures we introduced as a committee bill back in March, I believe, or maybe it was February. It directs the state forester to recognize the cost borne by non-industrial private forest landowners in the provision of public benefits through forest land management, and specifies the conditions under which the development of regulatory changes for non-industrial private forest lands will succeed. Just handed out to you, you'll find dash one amendments, which the chair provided from her bill file for us. I have not had a chance to look at those. I apologize.
Apparently nobody else did either. We have dash one amendments to this bill. Is that Christina, is that right? Correct. Okay. Well,
then I believe our witnesses will be speaking about the dash.
They will.
Okay.
We have first signed up George. Well, let's go with Christina McNitt and Mike Godin first to maybe explain it to us on the dash ones, and then we'll have you. Thank you. Good morning and welcome. Mike, I hope I said your name correctly.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's Godin, like Godin.
Godin.
That's how I memorized it.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt. This morning is the first time I saw the Dash 1 amendments as well, but they were produced at our request. And so what I did is I took what we submitted to Legislative Council, I hand engrossed it into the original bill, which is attached to my testimony. And basically, it's just wordsmithing. The substance of the bill isn't really change. So hopefully that'll provide some direction. The Small Woodlands Association is a voluntary trade association of non-industrial family forest landowners. Those are statutorily defined as landowners who have 5,000 acres or less. Non-industrial landowners represent almost half of all the privately held timberland in the state of Oregon, and yet we represent only 16% of the harvest. With me today is Mike Godin, OSWA's Executive Director. House Bill 2930 comes before you as a product of two interims of discussion among family forest landowners participating in OSWA's Government Advisory Committee. These discussions originally surfaced through the Department of Forestry's Committee for Family Forest Lands in the context of proposed rulemakings in front of the Board of Forestry. ORS Chapter 526.425 specifically addresses non-industrial private landowner assistance and includes policy language recognizing that non-industrial private forests make a vital contribution to Oregon by providing jobs, products, a tax base, and other social and economic benefits, and further declares it to be the public policy of the state of Oregon to encourage management of non-industrial private forest lands for tree production. So that's current law. The intent of House Bill 2930, as amended, is to add to these statutes some language that recognizes management of non-industrial private forest lands for values beyond tree production. Further, these values are shared by the public and include public benefits, including clean air, clean water, and wildlife habitat. Often, these values include management costs borne by the landowner, and when these benefits are provided through regulatory direction, the Oregon Board of Forestry and the state forester will be successful when they consider the importance to landowners of long-term regulatory stability and recognize and quantify the cost of private sector contributions to the public. My second phase handout is this publication.
Could you take that to the assistant?
Oregon State University hosted the Oregon Family Forest Land Symposium in 2001, and what the committee assistant is passing out is the product from that. The report. The symposium and the four regional roundtable meetings held prior to it tapped into opinions and challenges faced by family forest landowners across the state. More than 300 families shared their views on a range of topics, including their role within Oregon's forest economy, the general public's understanding and misunderstanding of that role, the opportunities and barriers to achieving sustainability of their forest lands, and their hopes for a policy environment that takes better account of their situation. In House Bill 2930, we tried to address some of those concerns, which we heard throughout that symposium as being a regulatory certainty or uncertainty. And the fact of the matter is that in Oregon, we're losing non-industrial woodlands to the tune of 22,000 acres a year to industrial industrial and other use conversion. So we're just trying to provide some policy language. I know it's words, and but words mean something, and there's already existing statute for non-industrial forest lands, which is where we're inserting this, and would appreciate the committee's favorable consideration.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Mike Gadern. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Christina has asked me to join her today in front of you to add some insight into why we think these words are important. We think these words are important because we are increasingly understanding that there are markets out there for wood. There are markets out there for some environmental benefits. But we are, as a society, at a very early stage of understanding how we can work together, and it's this type of policy language that will help us work together to make sure that we have family woodland owners, which we believe are a vital asset to Oregon, and the Oregon Department of Forestry and Board believe are a vital part of Oregon, and I believe the governor believes, and I'm sure many of you believe, that they're a vital part of Oregon. As we go into the new century, we've got to figure out how to encourage folks to stay on the land. The pressures, both regulatory and through societal belief, on folks to convert forest land to other uses are enormous. The ability for this country to supply its own sustainable needs over the long term can only be done if we have an empathic society that understands natural resource management. And through experiences that I see every day, and I've had myself, the beliefs and behaviors of people are changed dramatically when they experience woodland management through their families and through experiences of other families. It's all about beliefs. We're very good at figuring out how to incentivize people's actions through money and through regulations. We have yet to discover how to incentivize people's actions through being part of a community. We know it's possible because we see it in healthcare, we see it in other parts of society and how the communities come together and work together on common projects. The environment and the non-market benefits that family woodlands provide to society are so complex. We don't know how many species there are on the planet. We don't know how they interact. We are just getting our heads around it. But we think with the cornerstone of family woodlands, there is a adding diversity to the type of management that happens on Oregon lands and lands throughout the states, we have a better opportunity long term to be more sustainable. We are good at numbers. We have yet to understand and fully comprehend why people own family forest lands. When I first arrived in this state, I thought about buying some, and the advice to me from the economists was, don't do it, it doesn't pencil out. And I know many of you have experience, and there are bills in this legislature right now to try and make it pencil out. But we want to see something in statute that also addresses the beliefs, because there are 40,000 people out there right now owning family woodlands who know it doesn't pencil out, but still do it. And they believe in it. And it's how do we get our heads around and how can we support them, even if it's just through words. Because words mean an awful lot. In the report you'll read, you'll talk about, or you'll see that the woodland owners, they want to see that people understand them, they want to see that people trust them, and they want to see that people believe in them. It's not that we fear for our survival because we're doing the good or the bad things. We fear for our survival because people just don't recognize us. If you were to walk into Portland right now and say, how many family woodland owners are there in the state, you get variationed answers all over the board. But the most common answer is, what is a family woodland owner? And yet these people are providing the benefits and of non-market assets to the Portland society and to the entire Oregon society that people just do not recognize. So these words are important to us. We believe it will bring our woodland owners together in a common cause, which is keeping family woodlands as part of Oregon society. And that's a common cause. We're a diverse bunch. We manage for diverse things. We've got people from the left, the right, and all the way through the middle. But with words like this, this legislator can send a message to our members and to other woodland owners that say, you're recognised, you're heard, and we believe in you. We'll sort out the regulations, we'll sort out the markets, and we'll sort out the policy from here on in. But if you could send a message today, it would be a start. Thank you.
Thank you. Very nice. Any questions? Representative Half.
Number one, do we have a fiscal impact on this, or is there one?
Madam Chair, Representative Passman, Madam Chair, we have not received a fiscal impact.
Is there one?
Uncertain, given the nature of the bill. I've been operating under the assumption that there was not a fiscal impact, but I have not had a chance to speak to legislative fiscal office about the bill.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's our understanding or our intent not to overlay any additional requirements in the Department of Forestry. Rather, this is a complementary effort very similar to what the Department of Forestry already has to do in promulgating rules under the 527 analysis process. We don't really see this as competitive. There's actually a statute in our books on non-industrial forest landowners, and we just wanted to insert that language in the non-industrial forest landowner section, but it's not an additional regulation from our view.
Did that answer your question?
Well, yes, if I could. The I don't disagree with anything you said about the need to recognize the value here, but I do get troubled at putting in state law recommendations to professionals on how to make decisions. This reminds me of the bill we had the other day to ask biologists to try to avoid making certain decisions. And here in your bill, it says regulators, in this case I guess it would be foresters or professionals, should consider the value of long-term certainty in order to prevent short-term management decisions. I mean, what does that mean? What are you telling professionals to do? They should consider this? What does that mean? Do they say, okay, I've considered it, and now we'll do this? I mean, there's no, that it's just kind of a vague, uncertain kind of, what I sometimes characterize as squishy language that might be confusing to someone, and I don't think it actually, frankly, I don't think it represents what you're trying to do, and I don't think it's the kind of language that works well in law.
Representative, I trained as a participatory forester, which is a professional as a professional forester with a social and community background in terms of the psychology and conflict management. And I understand the question, and if I could respond as such, there is an increasing communications gap between professionals and woodland owners, and we are trying to figure out how that can be overcome. We think, or the experience I've had, is that there needs to be an equal partnership. Our society is so much top-down driven. Here is the science. And what we're saying is this science is becoming almost dogmatic. The information that is arriving at woodland owners is arriving in such a way, either through it does your trees good, it does it's good to reforest. We believe in those as well. What we're saying is there's information coming from our members up the other way that says these values don't connect with my belief systems and the reason I own forest land. So what we're trying to do is to widen the conversation. We're not telling the professionals what to do per se. It's asking them to broaden their vision and say it's not just about the trees and the values that we've had before in the 19th, 20th century. It's beyond that.
I understand that, Madam Chair, if I could. But what are you telling someone to do if she say, consider that? Does that mean I should consider that for 1 second? Does that mean I should hold a hearing? Should I just think about it and then go do what I was going to do? I mean, how do you enforce getting a professional to consider something? I mean, maybe what you want to do, again, I'm not agreeing with your thesis, but direct someone, and that's a law. You say, you must do this, or you must not do this. But when you say to a professional, whether it's a biologist or a forester or something, say, well, you should consider this so that maybe you'll prevent short-term management decisions. I mean, what I don't understand the directive is what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, again, Christina McNitt for the record. Let me try this in three phases. First, to give you an example of what we're trying to avoid. Second, to kind of share with you some of the findings from the Forest Land Symposium. And third, to talk to you about what's already required under 527 statutes. And hopefully I remember all three points as I start talking. The first, the type of example we're trying to avoid is when any public body, and I'm sure you're very sensitive to this in your own roles as state policy makers, but when rules are being discussed that affect how a landowner may or may not be able to recapture some of the investment in their forest land, that can tend to some unintended consequences or perverse actions, in fact. For example, if you're discussing how you're going to manage riparian areas, a landowner may, because they perceive some long-term uncertainty, they may in the short term decide that it's worth it for them to go ahead and log that piece of property or that riparian stream to the greatest extent possible under the current rules before they're regulated under alternative rules. Ultimately, that's not the best public policy or where the discussion is trying to arrive at. And so is there a way that we can discuss in a public forum? Is there a way that we can avoid those types of short-term management decisions because of long-term regulatory uncertainty? That's my example. What I'm going to read from you is in this publication that we passed out about family forest landowners and their concerns. It's on page 6 in the middle of the page. But basically, it encapsulates all the wide-ranging discussions that emerged, a pattern of four underlying themes and a list of three main stresses, two internal, two external. The four main themes were summarized as trust, equity, complexity, and uncertainty. We're trying in House Bill 2930 to put some language, again, in the statutes that talk about non-industrial forest landowners, some language that would help address trust, equity, complexity, and uncertainty. Again, is it perfect? No. Is it an evolving project? It probably will be. But under 527 currently, and there's a Department of Forestry person in back of the room who might even be able to address this more broadly, but when the Board of Forestry goes through a rulemaking process, they are already required to provide quite a bit of analysis under Chapter 527, and we don't see this to be anything that's not complementary to that. For example, they have to decide whether or not the rules are to prevent harm or provide benefit to the resource or site for which protection is sought, are directly related to the objective of the proposed rules and substantially advance its purpose, the availability and effectiveness, feasibility of alternatives. That right there might be a great place for us to discuss some of this language and proposed in 2930. So I just see this as a complementary effort dovetailing in the statutes.
Thank you.
Just a quick one. When I first read it without the amendments, it made almost no sense other than the wordsmithing. So I appreciate the fact that you're talking about trying to change the culture. The amendments, the very last one, the B, recognize the quality of the cost of private sector contribution to the public at large and seek to balance those costs between society and landowners, is in fact to me the part of this bill that says, as we're doing this, we should be in a place where there may be costs, because it implies to me that if we're going to take something away through regulation, that we should be giving something back to the landowner, including a tax credit or some other kind of deal if we take stuff out of production. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, but it was the first time that in reading it, it seemed to have any instance that might lead to a fiscal or whatever. Would you comment?
Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, and those are the types of discussions that we would like to have at the Board of Forestry. And it may be an opportunity to sit down with the Department of Forestry and come up with alternative management plans. There may be a variety of ways to encompass that discussion. It's just a recognition that I guess I would say that in the couple of interims that the Government Advisory Committee for the Oregon Small Woodlands Association has been meeting, there's been a constant discussion and perception that there's this progressive regulatory creep. While I can say with almost 100% agreement that our folks support the Forest Practices Act and believe in managing their land according to the best silvicultural practices, and they believe in that, there's also a sense or an unnerving feeling that when is enough enough? At what point has the individual landowner provided benefit to the public at the point where the public's going to start to bear the burden of that cost? And that conversation is just one that we believe needs to be had and vetted in the public arena on a regular and consistent basis. This isn't a solution or an answer how to address those costs, but we want to continue the conversation and make sure that it's had.
It's actually just a comment.
Okay.
I know a number of small woodlands owners in the Coos Bay area, mm-hmm. basically, who, in fact, when you look at riparian zone in particular, if they have a lot of creeks on their property, all of a sudden they have a lot of land to manage and very little possibility of getting anything out. And so I do understand the issue, and I know that there is a problem for a number of them because they don't have the acreage. That's why they're defined as a small woodlot to regroup some of that when they see it happening. So your example is a perfect one. I know that a number of them did make decisions they would not have made otherwise when they were seeing some of the stuff happening in riparian zones. And if they start to widen them, they start to look at their property and start to realize that I'm not going to have any property to manage. So, it was just a comment.
Thank you. Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All the family forest landowners are subject to the Forest Protection Act, and this would in no way change any of that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the other question I had, you actually answered already, and that was, you know, if you could give us an example of long-term regulatory stability versus short-term impacts. And I'm glad you brought up the streamside protection rule changes that went into effect, 10 years ago or so, and the significant effects that had with respect to the short-term decisions that were being made. And I think that's just a really good example of the types of things we're trying to look at and analyze and really look at all sides of those issues before things are finally put into rule and figure out the best way to do that. Because you're right, I mean, there's a lot of value here that accrues to the public, and yet we sometimes don't tend to take the time to really look at and quantify that and explain what that is.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Seeing none. Do you wish to make any more comments?
No, thank you very much. And I'm sorry I just got the amendments this morning, but I hope the hand-engrossed version helped out a little bit. Appreciate it.
If I could make just one, Madam Chair, in respect to that. Again, you hear my voice. It's not local. I've seen what happens when over a long term, and we're talking millennia now, you force private landowners off the land through whatever reason.
Right.
Sooner or later, society figures out that you have to bus inner city school children into family farms or industrial farms to give them that experience to make that connection back. We want to try to think about avoiding that because you come around 180 degrees 360 degrees back to where you started, which is how can you get young people engaged in natural resources and experience in the earth. And I think both the Democrat and Republican could take a huge step if we could figure out how we can do that without breaking the private land ownership connection. It's a huge asset, and whatever we can do, even if it's just words right now, let's start that conversation before we end up where we are in Europe, which is having to bus a lot of inner city youths into the countryside to let them know this is how it used to be, and your milk doesn't come from a carton, it comes from a cow. Your wood doesn't come from a paper shop, it comes from family woodlands. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a gentleman from the Department of Forestry. George, is it Ponte?
Pont.
No, sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is George Pont with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm a policy analyst. Just kind of the bottom line to start out is we really don't have any disagreement with the testimony you've already heard this morning. We have some concerns, and much of what is being proposed here, we feel, is already contained in both statute and Board of Forestry policy. So I'll just quickly go over my testimony. The fundamental value of the Board of Forestry is that forest landowners, both large and small, and the public have a shared responsibility for maintaining sustainable forests. The Board supports the landowner's right to practice forest management in an environmentally sound manner. In turn, the public must play an active role by supporting incentives and other non-regulatory methods that encourage investments in Oregon's forests to maintain and enhance environmental, economic, and social benefits. This value is articulated in the Board's 2003 Forestry Program for Oregon. The Board also recognizes the need to continually assess the unique challenges and opportunities facing non-industrial or family forest landowners and to advance policies that promote continued retention and investment in these lands. To this end, the Board has appointed and supports a Committee of Family Forest Lands as a key tool in providing input about potential impacts of regulatory as well as other program changes. It is already the state's policy to consider the economic impacts resulting from the regulation of management activities. The Oregon Forest Practices Act states in part that it is the public policy of the state of Oregon to encourage economically efficient forest practices that ensure the continuous growing and harvesting of forest tree species and the maintenance of forest land for such purposes as a leading use on privately owned land consistent with sound management of soil, water, and fish and wildlife resources. That's encapsulated in 527.630. The statute further directs the state of Oregon should provide a stable regulatory environment to encourage investment in private forest lands. The Forest Practices Act also requires the Board of Forestry, prior to modifying or adopting rules to regulate forest practices, to conduct a comprehensive analysis of the impacts of those proposed changes. The requirements of this analysis include consideration of non-regulatory alternatives and selection of the least burdensome alternative, assurances that benefits of regulation are proportionate to the degree existing practices are contributing to a resource concern, and an assessment of the regulatory impact on small and large forest landowners. Finally, it's a state policy, as Ms. McNitt testified, that Oregon recognizes that non-industrial private forest lands are an important part of Oregon's forest resource, and they can make major contributions to the state economy and provide many other social benefits. Therefore, it is the policy of the state to provide opportunities for long-term investments that will result in increased management and harvests from these ownerships. I think one of our main concerns is kind of the word quantify. I think that the Board forestry policy and the statutes do a pretty good job at this point of the recognition portion. The quantification of benefits to the public of clean water, clean air, to put a dollar amount on those, there's a lot of research that goes on, a lot of economic work that tries to put a number on that, and that's very difficult to do. And it's also kind of a fuzzy word, to be honest. So that concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions somebody might have.
Thank you. Did you want to address the fiscal impact, did you think, or is there any way to address that?
Excuse me?
Or is there any way to address that?
There really isn't a way to address it. In terms of staff work, it would increase staff work to some degree, but to say it's going to increase it, X, it's very difficult to say at this point.
Great. Any Representative Roblin?
Yeah. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Is there a word that would be less fuzzy from your perspective that would help?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
That's an honest answer. Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. George, I guess if we use the streamside protection example that we heard earlier, and the way that the dash, decided to read the dash one here, the way it's worded is to quantify the cost of the private sector contributions. So under that example, if we were looking at increasing the buffers to a certain width or raising the basal area limit or however you want to do that, we could very easily quantify the value that the private landowner is putting into that the private landowner's contribution, so to speak.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I don't necessarily disagree with kind of the concept of that, but to, I mean, we don't have the information that, we have information that identifies all the streams and their classification and such, but we don't have any idea of what is currently alongside those streams in those riparian areas that could be subject to harvest under the current rules versus any new regulation. We just don't have that information. We could look at a specific landowner and do that type of analysis, but to do that type of analysis for all forest landowners, industrial landowners, family forest landowners, would be very difficult. I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but I think then you'd be looking at a significant fiscal impact.
Any further questions, Mr. Paul? Sorry, my voice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't have anyone else signed up to testify for this. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2930. Patrick, did you find out from fiscal, make a phone call, or whatever you need to do to see what the fiscal impact might be? And
I can submit the Dash 1 amendments to them as well, so
they have
a better, more complete version to work off of, yes.
Thank you. I think that's the direction we're going to go with at this time, and we'll see where we go with that fiscal impact. Thank you, committee. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3082, and I want to call Lieutenant Derby and Terry Dick up. And first of all, I want to thank you both for meeting with me, and we have spent... I know you have spent literally hours working on this issue, and we're up to the Dash 4 amendments, which we just got. And I wanted to thank you for doing that. We have also Dash 2. Are they Dash 2? Oh, I'm sorry. I stand corrected. There's a Dash
4. I hope there's not Dash 4.
I have to do what I'm doing. Patrick, do you want to bring us up to speed first on what we did on this bill?
And
what we've done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will. We heard this bill first on April 6th. The bill, in its original form, provides a tax credit to farmers who add non-toxic dye to anhydrous ammonia to deter theft. And it would apply the tax credit beginning 2006 and require certification by a state police of dye, exempt farmers from liability for environmental contamination. The bill in its original form, as a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue, I believe our panel will discuss the Dash 2 amendments, which will alter the bill significantly.
And we have submitted a letter.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I could point that out. Yes, I'm sorry. The anticipation is that the bill will no longer require a referral to the Committee on Revenue, but will require referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and so we have received permission from the Speaker that if it's the will of the committee to do so, that would be appropriate.
Thank you. And I think that we'll probably have lots of questions from the committee, but maybe you can explain the Dash 2 amendments to it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Today I'm also here in support of the Dash 2 amendments for the Oregon Wheat Growers League and the Far West Agribusiness Association, which is a multiple Northwest state association dealing with soil nutrients. What we have in the Dash 2 amendments, Madam Chair, is basically a total rewrite, or I think as some call it, a gut and stuff. And I'll go through, I think, first from a 20,000-foot flyover just to give you a sense of what we're trying to accomplish and then walk through the bill if that's what you would so wish. I thank you for the opportunity to amend the bill into something that we can get total support behind from the grower distributor community as well as the Department of State Police. And I'd like to just publicly thank Chuck Taylor down at Legislative Council. I took this total rewrite to him, I think it was Tuesday afternoon, and Chuck worked hard to get this done. And I can say in my reading of it, which I just got this morning, I don't see even the need for a single change. So Chuck did a yeoman's job, and I'd just like to comment for that on the record. The basis of the program is, or the need for the program, is to try to find a way to help deter the production of methamphetamine in the state of Oregon. One of the methods that is used for production of methamphetamine is the Nazi method, which uses anhydrous ammonia as one of the base components. And as a result of that, we are seeing considerable theft of anhydrous ammonia, primarily in the rural areas of Oregon, from dealers and distributors, as well as farmers who have on-site storage or have nurse tanks in the field in preparation for application. The program, the basis of the program, changes fundamentally from a tax credit incentive to a program where it is a reimbursement grant for the cost of the additive, as well as providing several incentives in terms of indemnification of injury for those people who own the anhydrous ammonia and could potentially be liable for personal injury when people try to attempt to steal it and create either injury to themselves or potential injury to others in the community should the anhydrous ammonia be released. It is still a voluntary program. It is a non-regulatory program. The administration of the program has been switched from the Department of State Police to the Department of Agriculture, which I believe is likely where the program needs to be, and this was done at the request of the Department of State Police. And as I said before, the real incentive is not the financial reimbursement of the cost of the additive alone, but I think the real incentive for the grower and the distributor is the indemnification end of it. And the program does sunset in 2014. What I would like to do at this point in time, Madam Chair, is just kind of walk you through the Dash 2 amendments. Page 1 is a series of definitions for this act. One of the things that we needed to do was to very tightly define what we mean by anhydrous ammonia, that it is in fact a liquid or a gas that basically is one part nitrogen and three parts hydrogen. It does not include ammonium hydroxide, which is an aqueous solution of ammonia. It defines distributor. It defines what we mean by a non-toxic dye or an other approved additive. Non-toxic dye, there is one currently that is being marketed primarily in the Midwest. It's a product called Glotel that reacts with the air to form a very bright pink stain, and it shows up on the individual that's trying to steal the anhydrous ammonia. It will show up on his equipment because anhydrous ammonia, being a liquid, it flashes to a gas, and you'll get the stain on both your if you're trying to put it into a propane barbecue tank, it'll stain the tank, it'll stain your hands. It will also stain the methamphetamine pink. Hopefully they won't consider that to be designer meth. This defines user as well as distributor. To be a user, to be a person engaged in an agricultural activity using the anhydrous ammonia as a plant nutrient. So it very narrowly defines what product can be, what form of anhydrous ammonia and purpose can be treated. It basically goes on to talk about the purpose of the bill, and as I said before, the purpose is really to hopefully deter the theft of anhydrous ammonia for the production of methamphetamine. And it gives some protections to the people who lawfully manufacture, store, and use anhydrous ammonia for purposes in agriculture. Section 3 on page 2 states that the Department of Agriculture will be the agency that administers the program and issues the grants for reimbursement to appropriate people. It states that the grant will not exceed the actual cost of the additive, and this does not would not include any equipment or personnel costs associated with the adding. It is strictly for the cost, which currently is running about $9 or $10 a ton in terms of treatment costs for the additive. So it's a relatively minor cost, particularly in light of, I think, as Lieutenant Turbin talked about the other day, was the cost of methamphetamine in terms of what it really entails costing the state in terms of other types of cost further on down the road.
Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to interrupt you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, you said $9 a ton, roughly?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that's correct. Right now, Glotel, the price of Glotel is about $9 a ton to treat the material.
So do you have any idea how many tons would be required if, under the best of all circumstances, all of the product that would be subject to this were treated with it? How many tons would we need? What would that cost be statewide? Do you have any idea?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, we do, in the state of Oregon, we do have a tonnage tax on fertilizer that is shipped into the state for use into the state. In 2003, which is the last year we have actual numbers, there was 25,800 tons shipped into the state for use as a fertilizer. So about 26,000 tons.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, finishing up on page 2, reinforce that this is for the cost of the additive alone. And we also put in the bill that if a distributor is given a reimbursement for the cost of the additive, that the distributor may not then pass that cost on to the user of the anhydrous ammonia, or what some might call double dip. In other words, get paid to get reimbursed by the state and then pass that cost on to the user, and double his pleasure and double his fun. On page 3. It talks about the fact that the Department of Agriculture will establish a committee, and it defines who will be on that committee. It will be no fewer than 6 people, including a representative of the Department of State Police, the Department of Agriculture, an ammonia fertilizer manufacturer, a representative from Oregon State University, Extension Service, retail distributors, and an actual grower who is in production of a commodity. Those individuals will basically assist the department, number one, in putting together the rules for the procedure for submission of a grant to reimburse, and also specific eligibility requirements. They then, after the process is underway, they will then be the review committee that looks at the materials that are submitted to the state for certification. For a material to be approved for reimbursement, it will have to be certified by the state, by the Department of Agriculture, in conjunction with the Department of State Police, and at the recommendation of this committee. It will not be just a matter of someone saying, I have an additive, I want reimbursement. It will have to be reviewed. And specifically, obviously it will have to work. So it will have to be an effective or efficient means to either be a marker like Glotel, which stains individuals, or it could be an additive which either impedes or renders anhydrous ammonia inappropriate as a reagent in the methamphetamine process, or significantly reduces the yield of methamphetamine during that reaction. So it could be one of those two types of additives. But it will have to go through the certification process and be put on an approved list. And that will be done by brand, so it will be very specific. One of the things that that will need to happen is there will likely be no reimbursement done because for a period of time, because it will take some review and some input of data to the state for certification. And as you'll see on page 4, the minimum requirements will be scientifically valid data submitted on a specific dye or additive that indicates what its, obviously it needs, that it needs to work, but beyond that, what its impact may be on the crop that it's being used on. Specific crop residue analysis, and then any impact on the environment. We want to make sure that this material does not build up in the environment or create any unreasonable adverse effect. And the significance of this is particularly in the area in Oregon, one of the major commodity crops that uses anhydrous ammonia are the small grains, namely wheat and barley. If we have a situation where the wheat, for example, would pick up a residue of the Glotel or whatever the material may be, and it does not have a food tolerance, that product could be embargoed for shipment overseas. And since our grain from Oregon is commingled with grain from the entire Northwest at the port of Portland, that could in fact embargo all shipment of grain from the Northwest to countries like Japan and China. So it has a significant risk if we do not ensure that we have no impact on food quality products. And so this would be one of the main things that the task force or committee, along with the Department of Agriculture, would be looking at. My guess is that the Department of State Police would be looking more from the standpoint of, does the material work as a deterrent for the production of methamphetamine? The Department of Ag will be looking at it from its impact on food crops and the environment. The bill goes on, and I think on the bottom of page 4, you'll see the two immunities, which we believe will really be the incentive rather than the financial reimbursement. Section 5 gives immunity from liability for the distributor or the user if the material is used appropriately as a fertilizer at what are known as agronomic rates. It indemnifies them not for contamination with ammonia or nitrate, but contamination with the additive alone. Section 6 deals with the indemnification or immunity with regard to personal liability for injury, death, or property damage caused by those stealing or attempting to steal anhydrous ammonia from either a storage tank at the distributor or on the farm. Page 5, Section 9 sets up the sunset, and as you see, it basically in Section 8 repeals the operative sections of this act in June of 2014. Section 10 establishes a fund, from the general fund, an amount of $150,000. We believe that this may be, should be more than enough for the first biennium. As I had stated, the material will have to go through the certification process. We believe that most likely the soonest any product could be certified would be late summer of 06, because they're going to have to do some field trials to check for uptake into the specific crops and to ensure that we're not seeing any illegal residues. And so it would likely be fall of 06, spring of 07 before an additive would be likely used in any significant quantity. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Witt? Lieutenant Durbin, do you want to add anything to what he said?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin, Lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and Commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. I just have a few comments. One is that this this we really worked well together in the work group and tried to come up with something that would be a very good working model. And when we were in that work group, we realized that there was a lot of considerations that we had not accounted for that really did need to be taken into consideration, and that is some of these issues of where we could actually shut down the port and those type of things. And we had to be very careful about what we were doing and what we were trying to put into as an additive into the anhydrous. What I would like to say is that this goes far and beyond the distributor, far and beyond the farmer, and what it does do is it's another piece of the puzzle to stop these people that are conducting meth labs. And we hopefully will have Washington and Idaho coming on board in the next couple of years with tighter pseudoephedrine controls. They have passed in Idaho a bill out, and they have one sitting on a governor's desk in Washington, but both of those, as they stand right now, are watered down significantly, which means that unless we have the federal legislation that enacts S-103 on the federal side that basically does what we're doing in Oregon and Oklahoma and a few other states on a federal level, if that does not go through, then for the next couple of years we're going to be dealing with states on our borders, particularly the borders that eastern Oregon butts up against, and they're going to be able to go over there and get their pseudo, and they're going to continue doing the labs on the border side, which on that side it's anhydrous ammonia. And what that means is that we, and I just got a call this last week from an agency over there that had a tank. And what happens is when these tanks are in vehicles and they're discovered by our patrols on I-84 and all those areas over there, basically they're bombs. They're bombs waiting to go off. And if someone hits a car, or we basically have to shut down a highway for X period of time until we can deal with that. And we just had one in Umatilla last year where it went off and it killed the young lady in the car and severely burned the other three occupants, and they're going to be disfigured for life, and we as a state are going to be paying for some of those disabilities. And that's not a rare occurrence. In fact, the majority of labs over there, well, all of them, I would say about 98-90% are using anhydrous ammonia. So we somehow need to take care of that. Then if you go to the distributors, on the distributor levels and PPG and those areas in Pendleton will tell you that they get hit almost daily. And they're very, very concerned about when one of these tanks do rupture and go off because of the damage that's done to the tank and that cloud that expands 800. You got a 20,000-gallon tank. If that would have ruptured, it expands 850 times. And it's going to then drop down, and it's going to go low into the community. And it's a chemical that is very nasty. So with these additives, once they go in, and again with Glotel, what we found in this committee is that with Glotel, it would take a crop going in the ground this year, I believe, and then 2006 harvested before we would know for sure if we can approve it. So best case scenario, well, it would go in the crop in the ground in end of 2006 and harvested fall of 2007. So that's the best case scenario, but that's okay. We would have this vehicle at least that when these additives come along, we could start looking at them and start putting them into the anhydrous and start dealing with this. And again, the states that put this in, what they posted on the tanks was Glotel. Once the word spread throughout the meth community, those thefts stopped. Now, those crops are different than what we're dealing with here, and so we're going to have these people jump through. We're going to have that certification process, and Glotel and these other manufacturers are going to have to jump through our hoops. And what we've also recommended is that they're going to go to their group with Idaho, Washington, and California, and attempt to have them come on board with us and say, okay, if you're Glotel or if you're one of these other additives, these are the hoops that you're going to have to jump through in order to get into our crops and be able to use your product in these states. And so that would give us significant leverage and make them hopefully, and we believe that they will, pay the freight for the testing that will need to be conducted on these products.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Lieutenant Durbin?
Madam Chair, is the Department of Agriculture
going to... They are next. Okay. Yeah, we're going to have them come up and... it's probably kind of new to them, but we worked on this tirelessly to come up with a solution that we thought could work. And you're saying you both support the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I might add, you had commented earlier that instead of going to revenue, this will go to Ways and Means. It will wind up in the Natural Resource Subcommittee, and one of the members of that subcommittee is Representative Krieger, and he is one of the, I believe, four members of this legislature that is working to condense the 40-some-odd methamphetamine bills into something that's more manageable. So Representative Krieger is very knowledgeable of the methamphetamine issue, and I think it's the appropriate place to review this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you for adding that. Seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I wanted to call up the Department of Ag to weigh in on this. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture, and I brought with me Janet Fultz, the Program Manager for our fertilizer program within the department.
Okay.
The department supports the initiative to control the manufacture of methamphetamines in the state. This would be a new program to the Department of Agriculture, and it is not currently in the governor's recommended budget. We anticipate additional resources would be necessary to administer a program of this type.
Do you have any idea how many or...
We have not put an official fiscal impact together yet.
Okay. And I guess I don't know the procedure on that. Would we do that before or in Ways and Means?
Madam Chair, I believe it would be done in the Ways and Means process on the department. In fact, I believe the people who do fiscal analysis for the Department of Agriculture would need some time to analyze those, and the best way to do that in a time there would be for it to be done at the Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bocas, did you have a question?
No, I really have a comment for the okay. Department of Agriculture and not for Terry, but for Oregon State Police. And obviously, I'm supportive of this, but as I look through the previous testimony, we know that the state of Illinois, the state of Michigan, the state of Indiana, the state of Missouri, and if we pass this, the state of Oregon will all be doing the same thing. And it would make likely common sense here that whatever program, since at least five states will be reinventing the wheel here, that we get a commitment from the Department of Agriculture to do this in consultation with these other four states, because there's no, I mean consultation, I mean, let's find out what they're doing, because if they already have a program ahead of us of how to make all this thing that Terry went into, then it's better to, you know, duplicate their program to a standard that's acceptable to Oregon than reinvent the wheel, which could be very costly, as it's rated at $2 million in a fiscal impact in one of the other states.
Thank you. Any comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, surely the department would look at programs that were developed in other states. I mean, clearly we would have to look at the crops that are produced in Oregon, because we do have a highly diverse profile in terms of crops as compared to many of the Midwest states. But to look at the research and make sure it applies appropriately to Oregon commodities.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. Thank you very much. Terry, did you want to come back up? He looked like he had a comment on that.
Hey. Madam Chair and Representative Boquist, with regard to your comment, one of the reasons why the fiscal impact back in the Midwest is so high is because anhydrous ammonia is widely used in the in the growing of corn, and that's really where a tremendous amount of anhydrous ammonia is used. Actually, our bill, I think, will be, as far as we can tell, will be a model bill. We've submitted it to the Fertilizer Institute, which is the governing body over all states in terms of associations. And we think our bill takes the best of those other state programs and goes several steps further in dealing with indemnification and testing to ensure that the product doesn't cause environmental or residue problems.
Thank you. For the record, did you state your name?
Terry Witt.
Thank you. Now Representative Burrow feels better. I knew who he was. I don't see anyone else here to testify on this. And committee, we're in a work session. I would really like to move this bill to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I'd like to move the -2 amendment to the main bill.
Representative Boquist has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3082. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative Hass?
Yes.
Representative Roland?
Yes.
Representative Sumner?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
Yes.
Representative
Gomez?
Yes.
Chair Smith?
Chair votes yes. We've moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3082, and I have Representative Wood. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3082 as amended to the floor with the two-pass recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
If I may clarify, the by prior reference. Too much cutting and paste.
Yes.
Apologies.
Okay.
But to Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin has moved House Bill 3082 as amended to the Ways and Means, and the referral to revenue has been rescinded with the new referral to Ways and Means. So hopefully I said that right. Thank you. Any discussion? Representative Burley?
Madam Chair, I'm going to support this, but I just want to point out that this does have a statutory committee in it, which in principle I'm not always in favor of, but I think given the circumstances of the immediacy of this issue and the fact that this it does sunset, I'll go ahead and support this.
I appreciate that. Any other comments or discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hass?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative
Hunter? Yes.
Representative Byer?
Yes.
Representative
Gilbert?
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. We've moved House Bill 3082 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3082. And thank you again for all your hard work. Patrick, what do we need to do?
We can open a work session for the approval of draft requests.
We'll open a work session for the possible approval of drafting requests.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I've provided for you a couple of different items. One of them is on the form of a committee measure request, and on the back you'll find some proposed language. It's a request that Legislative Council draft a resolution that would designate the Oregold Rose as the official rose of the state of Oregon, similar to a bill we did before and similar to other concepts that have been discussed both in committee on the floor and in newspapers related to berries and such. This would designate the Oregold Rose as the official state rose, and the concept was submitted by Lee Johnson and at Harry and David. Also in your packet is LC 3480, which is a legislative concept draft that would add gray wolves to the definition of game mammals and allow the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish special status classification for gray wolves, allow the taking of gray wolves without permit if they're causing harm to livestock, direct the Department of Fish and Wildlife to establish a program for compensating persons who suffer loss or injury due to wolves. It would direct the commission to appoint an advisory committee to recommend methods for screening and paying compensation claims. It would create a wolf management compensation fund and continuously appropriate monies to that fund, and it would appropriate monies to the commission to carry out the compensation program. Now, because of the procedure that the speaker has outlined for committees to introduce bills as committee bills, even though we have an LC draft before us, the committee would need to approve a motion to approve a drafting request, and then we would either be able to take the LC draft that's before us for this one and utilize that at a subsequent meeting, or we would have to submit identical language to council and wait for a new LC draft that the committee has approved to come back prior to actually introducing it as a committee bill.
So we can introduce these today as drafting requests,
yeah,
and then they come back, and we can do a possible introduction of committee.
Yes, Madam Chair. The procedure is okay. For the committee to make a motion to approve the two concepts to send them to Legislative Council
for drafting.
Okay.
So moved, Madam Chair. Ask after stated.
All right. Representative Bocas has moved the two drafts to Legislative Council for drafting. So, any discussion? Representative Byer?
Well, I just to clarify, because nothing was said, but yeah, that this just is for drafting. It's not, you know, indicating support for a bill or opposing a bill. So.
Well, I don't like 3 pages of it.
Absolutely. And I guess what we do is we just are submitting these as drafting to be brought as committee bills, and we can discuss that further when we.
Thank you.
If I may clarify, Madam Chair, what will happen is when we receive the drafts back, then the committee will schedule a possible introduction of committee measures.
Right.
And then another motion will be required before the measure would be introduced as a committee measure. It's just kind of a two-step process.
It is a very complicated process. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Sumner?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative Katz?
Yes.
And Chair Stanks?
Chair votes yes, and we have received the required number of votes to send these to Legislative Council for drafting. So with that, we'll close our work session on the drafting request. We are done. We are adjourned. Good morning. Yeah.